the first thing to point out is that the technology itself is really not at all new. It's been probably 10 or more years since I was first using a product called Lotus ScreenCam to make narrated video demonstrations of software back when I was a product developer and a product manager. So, you know, and I think what changed fundamentally is the fact that we're now in the era of broadband, widely available to lots of people, number one, and that number two, there are some tools that are freely available to people which are not very widely recognized. And so I guess what kind of got me started on this about a year and a half or 2 years ago was noticing the availability of Windows Media Encoder, which is a free utility that even lots of people at Microsoft don't seem to be aware exists and don't seem to be aware is capable of making some very effective little narrated presentations of on-screen software behavior, packaging the stuff up into a nicely compressed WMV file that can be uploaded anywhere, like to someone's blog, and then progressively downloaded for viewing. So just a really easy, simple, effective way of communicating using moving pictures and sound. Much more effective in many cases than trying to document what's happening on screen with static screenshots or with text narrative.
Great information. So you get yourself started into doing screencasting by using Windows Media Encoder. Can you tell me a little more about this tool, whether it's free, what is its original purpose, and what you use it for? What does it exactly perform for you?
Well, I don't use it much myself now because the screencasts that I make, I always want to be more broadly available. So I prefer putting out a format that anyone can view. But also, I tend to want to edit the things that I do. So Windows Media Encoder is it's really a transcoder. It's a way of getting other media formats into Windows Media. And the fact that it has this screen recording capability is kind of a sidelight, I think, to the and that's part of the reason why people don't seem to know much about it. But the bottom line is that if you want to make a short, not edited video of some piece of software behavior that you want to communicate to someone else, it's an extremely effective way of doing that. And there are a number of interesting use cases for that I see, which haven't really caught on yet, I don't think, in the popular consciousness. One of them is what I would call user-to-user support. So if you look around on web bulletin boards and blogs and newsgroups and things like that, you'll see endless amounts of discussion amongst people about how do I do this in this application, and you know, lengthy written explanations, maybe screenshots. I think hardly anyone realizes how A, straightforward it is, and B, how much more effective it is to spend a couple of minutes just driving the application on your PC and capturing that interaction with audio voiceover and then uploading that for someone to see how to do something. It's a great way that people can show other people how to do stuff. And related to that is another use case that I think is potentially huge that people haven't caught on to yet, which is people who are users of software being able to communicate about the software back to the developers, in particular bug reports. So we've all been in the situation where the poor frustrated developer is trying to get the user to explain, well, what were you doing when such and such happened, and you know, that stuff always kind of bogs down. But here you can simply show and tell directly what's going on. So potentially a great way to feedback to developers.
Absolutely agree. Yeah, those are two fantastic applications. So Windows Media Encoder is a free tool that can be used to record your screen activities while narrating what is happening through your microphone connected to your PC. Do you normally do this live? That is, while you perform the activities, you narrate what you're doing. This is not done as an overdub later on, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even try to edit the stuff that I do in Windows Media. In fact, I don't really use it myself much at all now because I tend to be making much more highly produced kinds of things. But what I'm pointing out here is that apart from the more highly produced sorts of things that I do, there's a whole range of use cases where you simply want to capture some, you know, 90 seconds worth of demonstration for purposes of communicating to someone else how to do something or where the problem is with something. And so, you know, that tool is extremely useful for that purpose. But again, it's not sort of the focus of what I've been doing. You know, I've sort of gone on from there to see that there are modes of using this medium which are really, in my mind, related to documentary filmmaking more than anything, I would say. And the way that I think about this is that as all of us are increasingly experiencing electronically mediated versions of reality, right? I mean, a lot of our social interaction nowadays is mediated through networks. And so from that perspective, it's really interesting to be able to document the, not just how to use software kinds of aspects, but, you know, sort of why to use it. You know, what is this stuff really all about? What is the culture that surrounds this application or this service? And so some early examples of that were, and probably the most famous one was the Wikipedia movie that I made, or the screencast about the evolution of a particular page in the Wikipedia, which is serving for a lot of people who are not really, you know, advanced geek types. It's serving as a way in to understanding what the Wikipedia culture is and how such a thing could even possibly work. So people get a sense, I think, of the culture of that environment as much as anything, and it's been extremely effective. You know, and then I've had a few other similar experiences making documentaries about, for example, Delicious, which again is you know, can be viewed as an advanced tutorial on how to use Delicious, but it's also helping people, I think, to think about what are we really doing here as we engage in this kind of shared vocabulary or metadata vocabulary development.
Yes, indeed. So you like them? You like to call them more documentaries now rather than screencast?
Well, no, I mean, not necessarily. But I'm saying that's to me the most interesting aspect of what I've been doing. So, I mean, the thing that you just put up on the screen here is more in line with the kind of thing that you would expect to see from, let's say, a magazine like InfoWorld, right? So I've been doing a monthly series of pretty lengthy, like 20, 25-minute in-depth screencasts where I explore new development tools and technologies. And so the first one was IBM's Unstructured Information Management SDK. The second one was Flex 2.0. And the third one, which I just put up a few days ago, is about Microsoft's Atlas, which is their new Ajax toolkit. So, you know, these are quite interesting from the perspective of InfoWorld and what magazines like InfoWorld have traditionally done, because it's completely different from you know, anything either in print or online. You know, there's no way that a 2,500 word review of the Atlas toolkit or the IBM SDK could begin to communicate either in terms of depth or in terms of comprehension what can be put across in this medium. So, you know, I think you know, another interesting use case here going forward is going to be that. I think a lot of deeply technical information is going to turn out to be best communicated in this medium. And related to that, there's a sort of a marketing aspect to it. So, you know, a number of people have mentioned to me that they claim that one reason why Rails was so incredibly successful so fast is because of the screencasts that the Rails folks made, where people could invest 5 or 10 minutes and watch and hear this process of building an application from scratch using this amazing toolkit. Now, the toolkit is amazing, but, you know, you don't really get the sense of that as effectively and as quickly in any other way.
You've been mentioning duration of these screencasts. And there have been some very effective ones that are very short, as you have also been mentioning, some that take up to 20, 25 minutes. Do you have any recommendations in terms of the lengths of this?
So that just completely depends on what it is that you're trying to do. In general, the shortest ones are reaching the widest audience. So, I mean, there are some that are even just 90 seconds long. And in general, the one about Wikipedia, the one about Delicious, you know, these are in the sort of 5 to 8 minute range. And in fact, one comment that a lot of people have made about the Wikipedia one is that at 8 minutes, it's too long. So, you know, I think in terms of something that's going to reach a really large audience, you're probably not going to find, well, I don't know, you know, I mean, it's hard to say, right? It's, you know, people will certainly sit and watch an hour and a half long movie. You know, whether there is something in this medium that would command attention for an hour and a half, you know, I just don't know. I mean, I haven't myself come across a topic that merits that sort of treatment, you know. So what I'm finding is that in the case of these development tool screencasts that I've been making, I've been letting them run longer because I know that there are relatively fewer people who will be interested in any one of these topics, but the people who are interested will probably be interested to watch for half an hour and get a really deep, thorough treatment, right? It's not just sort of trying to communicate a single short idea.
I guess it would be also good to evolve into chunking up these into a smaller module sometimes so that people can zoom in right into what they want while keeping the thing very modular and accessible. Did you have an opportunity to check out, I'm sure you have, those 4, 5, 6 screencasts from the Microsoft Research Group when they presented at the beginning of March their RSS cut and paste facility? What did you think of those?
Yeah, actually, I know Jack Ozzie, and he got in touch with me for some advice on what tools to use to put those things out there. So I thought that was great. Although in that particular case, I was going to say that you didn't need the screencast so much because the software itself was accessible online. So you could simply go to the example, and it was pretty clear what was going on, right? But I don't know, what was your experience with that? I suppose it's also the case that things that aren't available online right now are shown in the screencasts, right? Like the interaction with the Windows tray, for example, right? And with native Windows applications, the only way to see that happen is in the screencasts. And so I don't know, I wonder how many people did watch those.
I think they were great, and I was so happy to see, you know, that there was an extended family of researcher using your same approach. I haven't seen very many of these outside of yours, and so it was very positive. I think it's very useful. I did watch all of them. I learned a great deal, and it's just another experience. It's more direct into understanding what is really going on. So I'm, from an educational point of view, from a learning standpoint, they're absolutely extremely valuable for me. So did you recommend Jack to use more sophisticated and expensive tools like Camtasia or something like that?
Yeah, I had him use, well, he ended up using Camtasia, although I would say that probably he didn't wind up doing much editing. So in his particular case, when he was just making little, you know, 1 to 2 minute episodes, apart from the format conversion issues, he might have been able to do that just as easily in Media Encoder, right?
What are, in fact, the key advantages of going to Camtasia over using just Windows Media Encoder?
So it's all about the editing. And I've gotten to a place where, again, these things are very carefully produced. In fact, I'm actually sort of chafing at the bit in terms of Camtasia because it is not as effective. You know, what you end up doing is working back and forth between the video track and the audio track, kind of you know, shortening up the video or lengthening the video to match some audio, or then doing a bit of extra narration in the audio track to cover some action on screen. And you know, ultimately, what you really want is a completely full-fledged video editing tool. So I've actually kind of gone back and forth. I mean, I've had, in some ways, better success in iMovie on the Macintosh from a pure video editing perspective. But the, you know, it's kind of like what I would ultimately like to have is three functions broken up and completely decoupled from one another. So the first one would be capture. So, you know, what tool I use to do my capture to some neutral video format shouldn't matter. I should be able to use anything, right? And then the second function is editing, and there I'd like to use, a best-of-breed editor that makes things go as quickly and effectively as possible. And third is then I want to be able to produce the stuff. Ideally, in for a long time I was focusing on SWIFT, on Shockwave Flash, as the universal delivery format. More recently, I'm moving into the use of Flash Video, FLV, which has the advantage of being lighter weight in terms of the playback, right? So SWIFT files, when you get into these longer video things, they tend to bog down, basically. They just chew up a lot of memory in the browser on every operating system. So, you know, FLV is where things seem to be headed, but you need the latest Flash Player version 8 or better to play FLVs in this progressive download mode. So I've ended up, for the ones I've been doing recently, producing multiple formats, right? So also producing QuickTime and Windows Media, which I would really rather not do. I would rather that there just be a single canonical playback format.
Absolutely. And then if you want to showcase a tool that is just on the Mac, what do you do?
So there, the best one appears to be SnapZ Pro, which is a combination of a screenshot capture and a video capture tool. So, you know, I've used that with some success as well on the Mac, and, you know, then editing in iMovie. Although, you know, iMovie seems to be set up, and maybe this is just my own limited understanding of it, but it seems to be biased toward, you know, kind of DVD formats, right? And so these things that I do can come in any shape and size, and I haven't really worked out yet how to deal with that in iMovie. I don't know, maybe you know more about it.
No, I don't. Actually, I saw some pretty outstanding, I don't recall where, screencast, and I think they were done on the Mac with a Mac tool, probably the one you just mentioned, SnapX, SnapZ Pro, where you could see good zooming in certain areas of a dialog box that you were looking at, a kind of a spotlight that was coming in to highlight certain things. It looked very cool and very effectively produced. I know that that's not easily done on the PC side, so I was wondering if you had any experience or exposure to those.
So I haven't actually gone that deeply into it, but my observation is that the difficulty is getting things, you know, into iMovie and out of iMovie. At least that's been the stumbling block for me. But anyway, you know, all this stuff is, I don't know. It's frustrating because you end up kind of putting things together in ways that I think nobody really thought about. So, you know, whenever that happens, which seems to always be the situation that I land in, you're kind of cobbling together solutions that were, you know, never really envisioned by the developers. And so that sort of takes a while to work its way out, and you know, that's a bit of frustration. But I want to kind of back up and mention a few things here in a sort of a larger context. And, you know, one of them is that apart from the enormous educational value that this stuff can have, there's also a tremendously powerful, I guess you would say, marketing aspect to this. And I mean that in the broadest sense. And so my best example of this is actually something that I don't think most people think of as a screencaster. It hasn't been called that, but I don't know if you've seen this, but about a year or a year and a half ago, the American Civil Liberties Union put together a little flash video, which was really an imaginary interaction between the clerk in a pizza shop and someone who's ordering a pizza, right? But the action is taking place on screen, and what you see is the clerk's order-taking application. And what you hear and see is the violation of every rule of privacy and every law of digital identity. So the woman knows everything about this guy. When he tries to order extra meat on his pizza, she complains that they're going to have to charge extra because she's got his medical records. And it goes on and on. Anyway, it's a wildly effective piece of, well, I guess propaganda, right? And now the interesting thing to me about this was that I had originally heard about it, I don't remember when, but a long time ago I'd heard about this thing. And then much more recently, probably 8 or 9 months after the thing first came out, I was forwarded an email from my sister, who's not a particularly technical person, and she said, oh, I just saw this thing. And her reaction to it was that it's really a shame, but this is probably how things already are, or if it's not how things already are, it's how things are going to be pretty soon. And so, in other words, she was basically resigned to the fact that this is what technology is going to be doing to us. And I thought that was interesting, but what was really interesting was the next day or a couple of days later, I guess it was Phil Windley, whose blog I read, was pointing to something on Kim Cameron's blog. Now, so Kim Cameron is Microsoft's digital identity architect, and Phil Windley is the author of the O'Reilly book on digital identity, right? So two of the leading thinkers in the technology community, and two people whose entire mission relative to digital identity is to prevent the dark vision that the ACLU portrayed, to prevent that from happening, and instead to create a world in which there really are laws of digital identity that respect us in the way that we want them to. And my observation to Kim Cameron was that I know that you're building this stuff, right? I know that you're putting InfoCard into Windows Vista, and I know that you've got all of this identity federation stuff happening, and I know that, you know, it's all good architecturally, right? But how can it be that there was this vision that was percolating through the popular consciousness for 8 or 10 months to the point where people are now assuming that there's no way that what you're working on will ever pan out, and instead it's going to be that dark vision, right? How could you not be aware of that, number one? But number two, you know, why wouldn't you be presenting in an equally compelling format? Why wouldn't you be presenting your architecture and your vision and showing us, you know, how and why things are going to be better? So, you know, I think that's really the most important message in this, from me to people in the technical community, is that, you know, it's really cool to be able to show people how to use software, but it's way cooler, I think, to be able to communicate your vision of what your software is really about and how it's going to interact with society, and why, in fact, if it's the right thing, that it is the right thing.
Absolutely great points. Well, thank you. Again, I don't know if you like to be called, how is it that it is pronounced? Tell me.
My name? John Udell.
I didn't see the H, so I thought maybe there was some Scandinavian origin and maybe some different way of pronunciating, but I do know some other John without an H, and indeed they're called that way. Okay, great, John. Those are absolutely great points. I appreciate your time and patience to go over these things with me. I am having a number of further questions I would like to ask you, but I don't want to stretch you too much. I think you've done a great job of helping me out, collect some information on this, and I will use it for an article that will include both your answers in audio and a transcript and some of my own comments on it. So I truly appreciate your contribution from Robin Good here live in Rome, Italy. This is all for today, and I hope to be talking to you soon again.
Okay, take care, Robin.